So the national forests were started in 1905, which is only 4 years before the town of Twisp. And then a couple years later, this forest here used to be called the Chelan National Forest. Rather than having a bunch of little tiny national forests scattered like we have now, they had huge forests. Like, there was only three national forests in the state of Washington, and so this was part of Chelan. So us and the Wenatchee were kind of combined at the time. And then over the years, through Congress and whatever, our name changed back and forth. It went from the Chelan to the Okanagan and back to Chelan, and you know, nothing is very static with the government.
A lot of the local economy at that time, of course, farming and mining brought a lot of folks here. And we didn't have the big ranches like you did in a lot of places, but we had a smaller type ranch. They used the forest a lot for grazing. And there was quite a bit of sheep grazing going on, and cattle. And the local folks, a lot of them would keep a few cows around to milk, and they did this a lot in the West and all over. They would milk their cows and sell the cream for the most part. There was actually a local creamery here in Twisp where they would make butter and such as that for the locals. Another big part of the forest use at that time was sheep grazing. And most every piece of place you could get a sheep or a cow, there was one at that time. And to go along with that, we also had a lot of salmon in the rivers and that kind of stuff at that time. We didn't have any dams to speak of yet or anything.
The highest number of sheep and livestock ever to be on the forest was about 1917. And that's when the president, you know, we used to have carrying capacities, so you could put so many head of animals on a unit area. The president basically said, we don't care what your carrying capacity is, just start throwing the sheep and the cows out there, because we need to feed the doughboys, and we need wool, we need leather, and we need meat for World War I.
But they would put all their stock together, the horses and the mules, and make a big pack string and ride, take them over to the Colville Indian Reservation, southern part of that. And he said it was covered Bocky Hill.
In the Pasaten, which is the large wilderness along the Canadian border up here, that thing would look like ants, I bet.
And a lot of the trails through here, the original ones, were made because of the sheep grazing and the sheep trails. And the ranger would have a certain amount to do with that, as far as maybe saying, don't build it there, you can go over here. And the building in those days was mostly figuring out where to go, and they might have to cut some timber here and there or some trees out of the way for right of way. But for the most part, they'd go where they could. Say take the Twisp River drainage. They had up, that was where the original ranger district or the ranger office was actually up here in Alder Creek. And the fellow might get up in the morning, and depending on what time of year it was, he might check right out and check and see what the grass was like in a particular area to see if the cattle could be turned on. The one ranger was in charge of the grazing, the timber sales, such as it was. They didn't at that time have any Environmental Policy Act to worry about or anything like that, or they were just doing what was right in their mind. And one old-time ranger, not from this district, but he asked his boss what he was supposed to do. And the forest supervisor at that time said, well, you're a ranger, aren't you? Go out and range. And that was his orders.
And at the time that the Forest Service was created, there were a lot of smaller little ranger stations around there. you would have a small little cabin and a ranger, and his wife was the cook, and this ranger was packing, they could pack heat at the time, so they were pistols. It was an extremely rough time for Forest Service people around. I mean, the ranger test that they used to take at the time was, how good could you? You had to pack a horse, you had to be able to shoot, you had to be able to defend yourself. I mean, it was straight out of the old West, the old ranger exam. And so you had a ranger and his wife and his horse and maybe a couple of little kids were in these ranger stations in a lot of the different canyons.
And instead of having cars, they had a few, but they had horses. There was a pasture right there at the Twist compound. So that wasn't there when I started working there. There was no sign of horses. We kept horses up at Alder Creek, or we kept them at the 8 Mile Ranch.
So in the Methow here, I would bet that there was probably 12-ish old ranger stations. And so you had all of these little spots because they had their horses. This was also pretty much before cars, because the Forest Service in 29 were pretty much non-mechanized. It was all straight horses, and you could only ride so far on a horse in a day. Well, then around 29, the Forest Service started buying Model Ts, and we got a bit more mobile. And so we started consolidating our ranger stations around, and so you've got Twisp. So the Twisp Ranger District is a consolidation of probably 8 ranger stations. And so the more mobile we got, the bigger the districts, or the land area that we were administering. At that time, there were next to no roads around here. The infrastructure was, there was next to no trails. We had had some humongous fires. In 1927, there was a monster gobbler that burned a lot of this country. And so we didn't have the access to get into the backcountry. So the CCC's built a lot of infrastructure around, a lot of the trunk roads and bridges and a lot of trails. They strung a lot of phone line to go to the lookouts. Then that was right during the Depression era. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt started the Civilian Conservation Corps, and this was kind of a public works kind of group where they brought unemployed people from New York and Chicago and just some absolutely destitute young men, and they were all men. There was no women involved with the CCCs. They came out here and they stayed in encampments, and there was a CCC encampment on this compound here, as well as there was some at Winthrop and also some south of here, but on the Okanagan National Forest. So this drainage and the drainage that Okanagan sits in, there were 8 CCC encampments.
They'd also had a flour mill here for a little while, and that went broke shortly. And that, it was actually, this is kind of a side story, but it was called Wild Rose Flour. And I talked to one older lady, happened to be my mom, and her granddad had some stock in that when it went broke. Well, one of the things he wound up with was a whole bunch of flour sacks. And anyway, here Mom and grandmother made her a bunch of underwear out of that flour sacks. And they told her she better keep her feet on the ground because in them years, the young ladies, of course, wore skirts. And they didn't want her doing somersaults because they said they'd be advertising Wild Rose flour.
We moved here, and my dad bought in 44, and we lived up Twist River. And at that time, all there was orchards. All the flats up Twist River, and everybody had orchards, and the main job was picking in the orchards. And all the families picked apples. I mean, that was the only way to make a living. And normally, they had little dairies. Everybody tried to have a little dairy cow, and they sold cream and milk, but everything was, and the families would pick in the orchard, and they had what they called orchard vacation. The schools, when it was time to pick in the fall, would let school out for 3 weeks, and all the kids would go help their parents pick apples.
Then we had a little bit of logging going on. We had quite a few sawmills spread out over the countryside, for the most part small ones. And then a little later on, the apple industry got going, and there was, believe it or not, quite a few orchards up and down the valley. And at that time, they didn't have cardboard boxes yet. So a lot of good pine trees went out of this country wrapped around a box of apples, because most all the mills had what they called the box factory, and it would make box shuck, which is a fairly thin piece of board about 12 inches wide.
That city block, the USA bought that from a local orchardist, and they owned a lot of the land in town here. And they're the ones that actually subdivided and split and blocked and lotted out the town. So in 29, that city block was bought. And then the remaining part of the 6 acres, the part that this sits on, the rest of the compound was built or was bought in 34.
Basically, right after World War II, there was a big push to get houses built, of course, all over the country. And so we started probably our biggest logging in this country at that time. A lot of the roads around here that we had were improved once we started logging, because for one thing, they had logging trucks and they needed to have pretty good roads to use them on. And of course, that brought in, to build good roads, you had to have good engineers. So the engineering department built itself up in the Forest Service, and they would do the road layout and the inspection. And then the logging company usually would do the road building. And in doing that, they got so much $1,000 basically knocked off the price of their wood.
We got pretty sophisticated with our tree planting program, is that we would collect cones from different elevations and different canyons. So we would put trees that were raised from the seed that were collected in localized areas, and so we had a much better success ratio.
When I first started, we'd plant, I would say, damn near 1,000 acres a year in young trees. We did a lot of planting. We had to plant 400 trees a day. Yeah, that was our quota, 400 trees a day. And boy, I'll tell you, so, the first day you couldn't straighten up for a week.
Yeah, that's a lot.
In the old days, we would be out there planting them ourselves. And in the new age, we would grow the trees at the nursery, bring them here. Somebody would bid on the actual planting of them, and then we'd have inspectors that make sure that you got to make sure that your roots are in there right, because if the roots have a J root in them or on top of a rock, they don't grow like they should be, and we want the forest to come back.
Yeah, big semi trucks would come from Oregon, from the nurseries there.
They would gather the cones here, and they would be the prime cones. They had certain trees that they
They were called Super Select or Super
Choice. Yeah, there you go. I couldn't even think of the word anymore. You forget, you know.
They would do a prescription at the first of the sale to say what ratio is there, like pine to fir to aspen, or whatever's there.
We have timber sale crews that help mark the trees. We have administrators that oversee the cutting to make sure that every tree that's cut's got a stump mark.
It's a real technical job, you know, where you learn all. I've already learned all the trees and stuff we had out there, but anyway, going out and identifying them and measuring the diameters and heights and the defects and that kind of stuff, and it's kind of fun to be able to go out there and treat the piece of ground like, you know, you thought it needed to be treated.
When I very first started here, Dick Gavin always took care of the wildlife. That was our main objective when we were marking timber. I was marking a sale up on Volstead, and we were up there on this ridge, and Dick and I were walking along. And he asked me, he says, how would you cut this timber? And I started pointing at the trees I'd take out, and there was some great big old mistletoe fir up there. And I said, I'd probably get rid of all that mistletoe. He said, no, you wouldn't. I said, what do you mean, Dick? I said, that's a disease. He said, yeah, it is a disease. But he says, these trees up on top of this ridge are not hurting a darn thing. And he says, that's grouse habitat. He says, that's where them blue grouse come in the wintertime. There's these big old woolly fur up here. And he says, that's why we've got a lot of grouse. He said, you leave all these. And so after that, and we'd always leave groups of trees for deer to hide in our thinning areas and stuff like that. Well, wildlife was always on the agenda, because we all hunted and we all fished, so we all wanted to take care of the wildlife.
You know, they give you a big opportunity to learn a lot of different things nowadays, and when us, you know, it was on the ground, out in the woods, and that kind of stuff, and most guys did not want to become a logger, because your dad or whomever was a logger, and my dad worked out of the mill over here, you know, for a lot of years, and a lot of other guys, their dads ended up working out of them mills too, you know, in them days, in the 50s.
In 1966, when I came to work, that was basically my first job. I was on a crew that was ready to go out in case there was a fire, and we would, at that time, we still did quite a little bit of logging, and when they weren't fighting fire, which was actually most of the time that particular year, we were out doing what we call stacking sticks, which means we were taking the brush and all the slash, if you will, from the timber operation for about a chain and a half, or give or take 100 feet off the road on each side, was piled up. And then at that time, most of the logging in here was selective, so there were still trees left, quite a few, and we'd pile it away from the trees, and then it would be burnt later, with the idea that'd be sort of cause a fuel break, plus a fire wouldn't be able to start at the road as easily and go out. Now, if you're gonna run a chainsaw, for instance, you watch some videos, and you work with a person for a while, they show you how to run a chainsaw and all that. And my first day on the job here, I painted a few signs around the compound because they were trying to figure out just what they were going to do with me. The second day I went up Libby Creek and we were cutting brush in front of a cat. We had a small 350 John Deere that with what they call the brush blade on it. And they gave me a chainsaw and they said, wear chaps and start it on the ground. And that was my safety orientation. But I guess they figured it meant how a boy could do something like that in those days.
But in 68, I was out there to the smoke jumper base. That was my rookie year. And they used to talk of Francis being the god of smoke jumping. And, you know, he started out in 1939 with his smoke jumping career and actually jumped here on the forest on the Twist River. One of the first fire jump. But anyway, why, as the story goes, Mike Tabler, who ended up a prosecuting attorney, I think, down at Waterville, him and I were out working on these old 797 chainsaws. And most people already know that two people on a chainsaw is a no-no. Well, here we were out here in front of the administrative building, the ad shack and the saw shop there. And here comes, I didn't even know he was coming, but, and he put one hand on Mike's shoulder and one hand on my shoulder, and we both stood up. And he says, "Next time, boys, I catch you doing that, you two are going down the road kicking horse turds." And he turned around and walked off. I looked at Mike, and Mike looked at me, and I says, "You know, Mike, I think that was God that just spoke to us." And we both walked back in the saw shop and just shook up.
I just couldn't stand working behind a counter. So I came back home and got a job with the Forest Service then. Was my first job in 1963. And I worked for them that summer on a brush crew, piling brush and fighting fire, anything else they had to do, worked in the campgrounds.
Yeah, we'd usually get laid off somewhere along the first part of December. I think in 1969, I worked till about the middle of January, and that was the latest, which was odd because that was the coldest winter on record in this valley. We got down to 50-some below. That was the big freeze. Yeah, that was the year that they decided they'd quit orcharding above Methow Much.
One year we were thinning up Benson Creek, and I mean it was snowing bad that year. I think it was 68, 69. Now we were just thinning to beat hell. We had to get an acre a day because that's what they required. Some days we'd get two, and the next day we could screw around if it was snowing or raining. But anyway, we was snowing on thinning on snowshoes.
68 was when they had the 4 foot of snow at 50 below zero.
When the CCs come in here, they did a lot of stuff, same as a lot of the Forest Service people, with what they had. You'd take a tree about so big around, you'd split that tree, and you'd have two halves, of course, and it'd be about so wide, you'd take about two or three trees' width, and you'd have the top of a picnic table. Then you'd take some smaller trees, and you'd build your legs. And you got everything there made out of wood, and you probably got half of that from just cleaning out around to make the picnic area. Well, after about 20 years, that's natural wood. It goes through all the process of rot and stuff. So in the 50s, we decided, well, we better replace a bunch of these. We had an old fella here in the district who he wasn't old at that time, but named Audie Peters. He pulled into he was working recreation at the time, and part of his job was replacing these tables. Well, he pulls into a campground, and a fella comes up to him and just mad because he doesn't have any firewood. So he says, "Okay." He grabs his chainsaw and goes over and cuts up the guy's table. Well, he has a table in the back of his truck to replace that, but he doesn't let that fella know what he's done. So,
yeah. I think the Twist Ranger District was looked at as being probably having the most efficient timber management program, being able to get our allotted harvest out, and call it get the cut out type of thing. And I forget just exactly how much timber we produce each year, but it was a significant portion of the board feet of timber that was produced by the forest. And some of the ranger districts struggled with getting the job done, but we had a really strong timber staff, officer, and crews. So that was never a concern of mine, of being able to meet that part of my responsibilities. When we got here, there was a very strong, vibrant sawmill operating in town. I forget the name of it. The district, both Winthrop and Twisp, were really supplying that mill with really high quality logs, pine and fir, and then with a lot of people employed, local people employed there, and it was an important part of the community here.
bleacher lookout. In fact, there's on a clear day, you can see it on a point down here. It's one we have left. Mm-hmm. And it was there in the 1920s. And somewhere around, I've got a diary of a lady that was named Basut that was on that lookout with her husband. And there again, it was same as with the old ranger. She was doing, they were building a ground house at the same time. And at that time, the lookout, they'd taken a fir tree, build a ladder up it, and part of that ladder is still there, but I'm not going to climb it. But you get up there, and then they're just kind of, they called it the crow's nest, and that's about what it was. Like on a ship, like you'd see at an old pirate ship almost, you'd get up there and look around for fires.
Look, 2 days a week I would spend during prevention patrol. 3 days a week I would go to a lookout. I would either go to Leecher Mountain Lookout, or I would go to Lookout, Mountain Lookout. And that's where I lived for that period of time. It was very, very unique, a very special living situation. I felt very fortunate to have it because it's an opportunity that's not provided to many. And as a lookout, what you do is you're watching for fire starts, be they lightning, nature, or man cause.
I was born 3 miles south of Twisp. There's a big weeping willow out by the Loop Loop Highway, and I planted that back when I was a year old in 1956. And that weeping willow was where our place was. A little log cabin, and it burned down. My dad worked for the Forest Service, and I grew up with Dad taking us to lookouts. And in fact, when I was 4 years old, we went to Leecher Lookout, and I was telling everybody I wanted to be a lookout. So, and in school, you're always asked in school, well, do reports on what you want to be and stuff. Mine was always firefighter lookout, and that's what I did. I did firefighting, did helicopter stuff in the 70s, and then 78, I did Chelan Butte Lookout, my first one. I'm just up here all the time, and it's like I just seem to, any little thing different, like a flash or a flash of a mirror off a car or something, I notice it, a dust, anything. I just pick it up with smokes, and we have what we call the sleeper, and that's what I'm watching for right now. We've had a lot of lightning this spring, and I'm watching for the sleeper. And the sleeper is like a hiker. He gets tired and he gets under a tree and he'll just go to sleep, and then when he wakes up, he takes off, and that's what the fires do. And they take off. And it dries out, like if it rains with the storms, it'll dry out under the tree. Sometimes the sleeper will be a couple months later. So I'm watching all the time. I'm watching for sleepers, no matter, you know, because they can sleep for a long time. They've been known, fire's been known to sleep all winter. This one guy was telling me that they reported water dogs, and water dogs are a little moisture, it's from the rains and stuff, you get the low clouds. And they look just like fires sometimes, and he said that they reported a bunch of those, and I thought, well, that's cool. And I've reported a couple water dogs. And every lookout, if you're not a good lookout unless you make a mistake, or not, they're not mistakes, but you're not, when you're a lookout, if you haven't reported dust, you know, or water dog, or, you know, a false alarm, you're not doing your job. Things would be really quiet, and then all of a sudden, the clouds would start moving in, and so I tell them that there's buildups, and that it's becoming active, the cells are becoming active, and then when I start seeing lightning. When it hits the tower, it's like you can smell the ozone. You can hear like a whistle noise, and it just kapow, and just the flash and everything's all at the same time, and you can smell the ozone. Rotten eggs. I mean, really, really rotten eggs. And that's usually when it hits the tower. I started reporting the fires. You know, I tell them the characteristics of the fire. If it's a jumper show, or if it's a engine show, and that's when the radio gets going. It'll be nice and quiet, and then I wake everybody up.
Once a fire is detected by lookout or aerial observation or by the general public, it's called in to a dispatch center, in this case a Forest Service dispatch center that's in that geographic area. Then it's up to the geographic dispatch center to determine probably the best resource to respond, or a combination of resources to respond. And in the case of the Smoke Jumper Base, they've determined perhaps that it's backcountry, fairly remote. It'd be very difficult to get people to hike into it, or even to arrange for a helicopter and ground vehicles. So they may elect us to dispatch the closest and fastest resource, which would be smoke jumpers. My first year is 1957, just a week out of high school, and after the 4.5 weeks of training, of course, we were ready or eligible for a fire, which in my case got a fire the next day. In terms of the year that the person starts, the critical thing is that first fire jump. After all of the training and making that first fire jump, that's pretty much the first rite of passage, which then makes you eligible for called a rookie smoke jumper pin, and it's something that's treasured, mine being here on my put on my ring. And so that kind of gets you over that first hump and that level of respectability after you get that first fire jump completed. And again, with this, you have these enduring friendships. There's a tremendous amount of camaraderie, a very high esprit de corps. And so once we get the call, it'd be a matter of getting suited up, the briefing for the pilot jumper crew, and usually off the ground in about 7 to 8 minutes after the fire call comes in. Then it's a matter of what the distance might be. Flight speeds may vary from 160 to over 200 miles per hour, depending on the type of aircraft. And then once over the fire, it's a matter of determining the kind of a strategy and the tactics, how many jumpers would be employed, and then going ahead with the jumping or the drop process. I thought there's a lot of value in the way we fought fire then, that with the smaller ranger districts, in this case the Twisp and the Winthrop, that everyone took part in the fire activity, from the district ranger on down. But everybody's a part of that fire organization, supported it. I felt the esprit de corps was a very, very high through the ranger districts. And the Twisp Ranger District had some excellent seasoned fire people. You know, the John Brooks, Dick Gavins, and just a lot of them. You know, had a lot of fire experience and were very, very effective and good at what they did.
The thing about fire in those days, if they got a bigger fire, they didn't have the big crews they had nowadays. They'd come down either to the mill or at one time in 1929, when they had some fires going on, they came to the local rodeo and just gathered up all the local people with their riding, and that was their fire crew. And of course, young farm kids were fairly used to most hand tools, and that's what they had, was axes and shovels. And at that time, they'd come up with the Pulaski and such as that, and that's how they fought fire. And I'm sure on the bigger fires, a certain amount of their strategy was, we hope it stops when it gets over there, type thing.
It was the Twist Ranger District and the Winthrop Ranger District at the time. And the two headquarters are only 10 miles apart. So there was a bit of a competition, you might say, friendly competition between the districts. And but we all pulled together when needed. And I think a good example of that is when we had fires.
We used to work fire in the summertime if you were on the marking crew or the brush disposal crew, it didn't matter.
And it typically seemed like it was towards the end of the day, and Jim Melton be on the radio, "All field units return to Twisp. All field units return to station. Fire call." So we pack up our gear and hike out, drive back to the station, change our clothes, put on our, get our fire gear together, and form up in, you know, small squads or groups to go out and locate the fires that the lookouts have found.
You know, I was assistant ranger, and I was one of the firemen right then. The fire bell rang. That's an interesting thing we had. You had the district ranger, and you had, they had several assistants. You had the timber and the fire and the recreation and the administration. But when it came to fire, you have a guy that's lower on the totem pole, but that has a huge amount of fire experience. It's when it comes to fire, that guy with the most fire experience actually floats to the top of the heap, so to speak, and they become boss. You've got the district ranger is really almost working for the fire boss.
I remember going out in the fire, and I was impressed. It was like, here's the district ranger out there working with us. John Brooks was the crew boss, and as the crew boss, you know, he was lower down the food chain, so to speak, than the district ranger. District ranger, when you go out in a fire, was actually working for John Brooks as the crew boss of that fire. But I was impressed that the district ranger would put his fire clothes and come out there and participate. He was a hands-on guy.
They would get away, and we had some big fires. And one I will never forget is in after a big lightning bust we had, and the next morning the fire calls start coming in, and we start sending out crews of two or three people to each fire. And after about eight or nine fires came in, the district was pretty well drained. And another fire came in, and we looked around, and it was myself and two or three other people who really didn't care to go on fires if they could avoid it, although everybody had to go eventually. So I rounded what was left up, and we got in the vehicle and headed out down south of Benson Creek somewhere. And when we got to that fire, it was about a mile off the road. We had a hike into it, and by the time we got there, the fire was going pretty good. And we were not able to handle it. And we had one airplane in the air spotting the fires, and there was a drop plane or borate plane available, and they asked me if we should put that load on this fire or the one over the ridge, which was going pretty good too. And I said, well, you make the call, you're up in the air, you can tell better. So they dropped it on the other fire, and our fire got away, and it turned into what we call, I think it was the Leecher fire, that eventually went to 3,000 acres and came down into Benson Creek and threatened some homes and everything. So here it was, all the different fires that happened, and they were all taken care of except for the one that the district ranger went out to.
The mill went on the fires. I mean, that's why we didn't have too awful many big fires back then. Because if a fire broke out, the sawmill people were out there. I mean, they didn't want to see their timber burn up, so they were on them fires as fast as we were. And so that's one reason we didn't have a lot of big fires back then. Because they were there, the cats were all ready to go, and the crews were there. And so that kind of saved our bacon a lot of the time.
John was one of the first ones that I ever went on. It was my very first fire that I went on. And it was up Benson Creek. And we hiked, and I thought it was a long hike, but we had these what they call Fedcos, ladder hikes. So we each had one of those. It took us about half an hour, 45 minutes to get to the fire. And just a small, little smoldering lightning strike. But by the time we got up there, we were pretty well wore out. And this was late 80s, early 70s. And there were still crews from Crown Zellerbach that were working up there. And this one crew person who had put line all around the fire with a double bit axe, he only had one arm.
Ted Bolin.
That was Ted Bolin. And that was a pretty good initiation to the first fire that I'd ever been on.
We had a fire blow up and come right towards about, oh, I guess the wind was blowing about 60 miles an hour. And we were right on a river. And so I told this friend of mine, I said, grab your pack. I said, we're getting in the water. So we just grabbed our bunk. We had those cots. We just grabbed our cots, went down, walked out in the river, and boy, everybody followed us. And we sat there, and that fire just come roaring right through the camp, burnt everybody's cots up that was too dumb to take them with them, burnt their packs up. There was guys just really crying and everything else. They thought they were going to die. And I said, hey, don't worry about it. There's so much wind there that we're going to have plenty of oxygen. We're in the river. It can't burn us. So we just sat out there and let the fire go. Next morning, it was 7 miles past us. That was one hot burning son of a gun.
And I remember one time there was a fire up by War Creek. And the fire had burned. And we got a crew together. We went up there. And we're working hard. The hell attacked Lake Chelan. The Chelan repellers came in, and they dropped in some pumps and dropped in some repellers. And it seemed like we were making headway, working away on this fire. And we got the call from Jim Melton. He was across Twist River at a vantage point. He could see the fire. And he says, you guys pull out. And I remember, I think pretty sure someone said, God, we're starting to get a handle on this, Jim. He says, no. He anticipated some danger, and there was danger because the way fires burn sometimes, they can burn quickly, and you can get a re-burn in the same area. It's not everything's burned to crisp. It might burn through the crowns with a wind-driven event, then come back and burn again. But he anticipated the danger that we, in the dense canopy of the forest, we could not anticipate. So he pulled us out, and the fire did blow up. And so when I went out on fires, knowing Jim Melton and Terry McCabe were always covering our backs. You know, you have your own responsibility, and your crew boss has that responsibility on the fire. But those guys were always there looking out for you.
Used to enjoy going to fires and spending all night out there if it was a small fire. But the worst part was the big fires, you know, where you had to spend a week on them and mopping up and all that kind of good stuff. But that just went right along with the territory. My mother grew up here down in Gold Creek, and she had a place they called Grouse Hollow, and it was nothing but big old pine, you know, and they'd burn out underneath there and keep the grass burnt down, and about every other year they'd do it. And the Indians had the right idea by burning out areas, you know, it saved them a lot of land. They see it themselves firsthand, and now we have to learn it through schools and all that, you know. And there's not many folks left around that have come from the old school, you know, that can teach these guys. You know, I remember some of the younger professionals that really wanted to go out and run around with guys like me and John Brooks and whatnot and learn the old school ways, you know, and not just the book, the old school. And I can appreciate those kind of guys.
So everybody was a firefighter, and that has changed hugely.
Thank you. stood on the mountain, two feet on the top, put my head in the clouds and took time.
Traditionally, the Forest Service was very a white male-dominated organization, and that was pretty much true when I got here. Although there was a scattering of women who were beginning to gain a foothold in the Forest Service. So we had a real strong program to try to bring in more women and more minorities.
I came here initially to stay with my aunt and uncle who lived here since 1972. And so the first time I came out, I was 13 and fell in love with the area, and then came out again when I was 15. And then I lived here every summer during college. And so that's how I made the connection with the Forest Service. I knew a bunch of people that worked at the Forest Service, and they knew I was graduating with a degree in biology. So they said, you should apply. We have some positions opening in fisheries. I remember the phone call I got saying I got the job, and the guy, I said, well, what will I be doing? He said, well, you're going to be snorkeling, looking at fish distribution, and you're going to be walking up rivers, looking at fish habitat, and you're going to be hiking into lakes and surveying lakes. And I said, are you joking that I'm going to be paid to do that? And the guy said, yeah, that's... Among other things, those are things you're going to be doing. And I was ecstatic and couldn't believe it and felt like it was a dream job.
The hiking was pretty much out for a while, so I went to run in the district crew then, the YCC crews. And so I run them for, I think I run them for 3 years and did all kinds of work with them, building fences and putting in docks and all the these horse unloading ramps you see at these different trailheads, we built them. We built practically all of them, in fact. We did the horse camp, put in all the grates and built the feeders. But it was really a good program for those young kids. And they loved doing the dock work up there at Black Pine Lake when we built that dock. I think that was one of their most favorite jobs because they got to dive in the water, and it was hot during the summer. And we built that one dock way out there at the end. And Timmy Thew and this one young girl we had were on the swim team here in Twist. And I asked him, I says, how deep is it off that end of that dock? And old Tim, he went down as far as he could go, and he couldn't go any further. He says, I can't find the bottom. So he came up and got a great big rock, and he went down until he couldn't go any further and came back up. He said, I still can't find the bottom. And she did too, and neither one of them, Nelson was her name, and neither one of them could find the bottom off the end of that dock. And they were good swimmers, so you know, that's pretty darn deep. But it was interesting, especially with those kids, because they were all anywhere from 15 to, I think it was 16, I think was the oldest, yeah. 15 to 16, because every once in a while I'd get one that could drive. And I'd get their driver's license and let them start driving the crew rig for me so I didn't have to drive.
And it's amazing how many of the volunteers that we had that worked for us that became Forest Service employees. Matter of fact, I hired a silver medalist swimmer, David Burkhoff. He was on our trail crew up here. And it just so happened that my kids were on swim team about that time, too.
He was gold medalist, Olympic swimmer at the, I think it was the Korean Olympics. And he was one of our volunteers for the summer. I remember him going down to the Twist pool and showing the kids how to swim. He and his coach developed another method of swimming. He did the backstroke, you dive underwater, no, the breaststroke. You dive underwater and you swim. Back then, they used to come right to the surface and swim. They found out it was faster to stay underwater as long as possible.
But our greatest effort and success, I think, was in working with the Native Americans. And there was a strong interest on the part of the tribes, nearby tribes, to try to find employment for some of their young people. We did something that was quite unique with them. I met with the, some of the tribal leaders, and we said that we would go out of our way to bring several of their young people over here to try to get them started with a jobs and hopefully a Forest Service career.
And there were, at that time period, there were some, Jim Holbert actually did that, one of former. He got together with a tribe, and they had some tribal folks come over, and I can't remember what the program was called, but so helped develop their skills. And we're working with them on fires, they're working with the timber department, you know, learning the skills you need for marking trees and things like that. So the volunteers got sometimes to interact with somebody from the Colville Indian Reservation here. So normally you wouldn't come in contact if you're going to Berkeley, California, or wherever you're going, Penn State, come to share a bunkhouse with somebody from the Colville Indian Reservation.
But some of them actually ended up getting good jobs and going on to different districts and getting real good jobs with the Forest Service.
I did get to work with young people. There used to be a program at the high school, and let's go back to Dennis Young again. And this teacher would notify us, you know, that he'd have a student or maybe two students who he would like to place here to learn office skills and maybe beyond. And I have a friend who was 17 when I met her, and she came to work here, who is still one of my very best friends. She lives in Sheridan, and she is a Forest Service employee, in fact, retiree now.
So at the beginning, it was Sally Portman and myself were the Wilderness Backcountry Rangers. We had basic forestry jobs, so working with them was fine. It was just keeping them motivated and safe was the two most important things. So we would start off the season as like Wilderness Rangers. We would hike the trails and bring a small saw along and an axe and Pulaski, and we would essentially start clearing the trails, make the determination how much blowdown there was on each individual trail. And so we could clear what we could, and then we would get a trail crew in, or sometimes they had contractors at that time period doing some of the trail clearing. And then later on, we start getting volunteers because there was more work that needed to be done than we actually had people for. So we had volunteers, and each summer we've had 2 to 3, usually college-age folks, who were still or just, had just recently graduated from college, come and spend a summer with us. So when they came on, you would spend, I'd say, 2 weeks to a month until their skill level, because some of these folks had never really been in the forest to speak of. They wanted to, but you had to get their skill level so they would be able to go out by themselves. Some of them even took 2 months. Everywhere the rangers went, one of them would come along. So you would teach them the basic safety, how to use the tool, and camping. You know, some of these people had never camped before. It gives them a lot of pleasure to see them, that their skills develop over the course of the summer so they can go out independent. And a lot of them were young and they were fit. And if they weren't fit, they would get fit pretty quick. But when you're running a cross-cut saw and you hike up some of these trails where there's some of the old-growth trees that have fallen in the trail, you could spend hours cutting one tree opposite Waits falling in the trail. And they all had great experiences. And the other volunteers, that was one of the, they were meeting other volunteers from all over the country, men and women, and then meeting the locals, getting to know the outfitters, the packers, people like Johnny. Johnny was only just a few years, but getting to meet the local characters, and to go up and be standing on the ridgeline above Oval Lake and just marvel at the view of what we saw. And they were getting paid subsistence. I think it was like $15 a day to cover their food, and they had the bunkhouse to live in. But most of them, they wanted to be out in the wilderness. That's what they came here for.
From when I first started here in 1978, things grew with budget and with political shifts and whatnot, with adding a bunch of needed support to the different resources, especially in the wildlife and watershed and arena and soils and things like that. Our employment base grew a lot here, and so being able to sit in here and instead of sitting next to a timber management person, maybe then having to sit next to a wildlife biologist or a watershed specialist was a big change, but a welcome change, because it taught me a lot.
Eventually they got away from scaling logs totally, and you could see the writing on the wall, you know. The scaling's going out, and eventually the cruising is right now is down to where we're not selling many timber sales at all, and if we do sell any, they're a real selective cut, you know. It's not like it used to be, but we overcut a lot of stuff. You know, you don't think about it when you're doing it, you know. It seems like it's pretty much to the contract speculations, but you know, as it turns out, we overcut a lot of areas, you know. And if I used to find an area out there that I knew I really didn't want to see cut down, a riparian area, I'd save that area, not tell nobody, you know, and I'd mark way out around it, and they're still there to this day, you know. I've gone back in Yaki Creek and down in that country, and spots that I know are still there, and they're still good and green and, you know, plenty of water running.
Well, when I came here in 82, we were still doing two shifts a day. So, because we still heard, there used to be an absolutely huge mill right across the river on this side of town. Mm-hmm. And you know, you'd hear the whistles twice a day during shift change. It was about 81, 82 is when the mill took a nosedive.
And it was an important part of the community here. And at some time, I forget the year, probably in the mid-80s or so, the mill closed down. And that was really difficult for the community and people living here. So a big cultural change, I would say. Shortly after we got here, I would say within a year or two, the country was going through a pretty good recession. And so we had to do some downsizing. And that was difficult because, you know, we're dealing with people who've been here for a long period. And to tell them that their job either had to change or that they had to move or retire was a difficult thing.
The community impact that came as a result of the change, I saw it. I saw families that worked at the Wagner Lumber Mill that then converted to the Crown Zellerbach that had been in this community forever, or for a long time. And their whole economic base was uprooted. And there wasn't anything in place to help them. Their lives were torn up. They basically had to reach out and find other aspects that I don't know a family today, or there's a few families today that I know that are still in the community. The majority of them are gone.
You know, ability to put out timber volume decline, you know, that was happening all over the Northwest, of course. And mills, infrastructure were closing down all over the Northwest. There were a few that were able to remain solvent, and that's where our log buyers then shifted to. So like our sales that used to be logged and hauled to Twisp or to OMAC now were being logged and sold and hauled to Kettle Falls or Wenatchee, or even as the highway, after the highway opened over to the west side mills. Right now, the major purchasers are on the west side, out of Darrington and Burlington, and then Boise Cascade out of Kettle Falls. So, and that makes a big difference in the values that we were able to generate then from receipts for timber. And you know, receipts from timber are a big part of what helped sponsor things like schools and roads and things like that in the communities. A lot of support came from logging federal timber, and that changed dramatically.
I remember moving here from North Dakota in 81, and my wife was a she had a couple of jobs in North Dakota. We didn't have any kids. I was working here as assistant ranger. She wanted to get a job. She started going around town looking for a job, and the city matriarchs pulled her aside and told her, listen here, sweetie, one job in this town is all that anyone can expect. Don't even think about getting a job. And so the interest rates were 18%. There were a lot of unemployed mill workers at the time. The economy in 81 was pretty dang tough around here.
The forest was going through a planning process at the time to produce a new forest plan, which would then designate how much timber would be produced on the forest. And the feeling on the Twist Ranger District, and I think on some of the other ranger districts, was that the numbers they were coming up with were going to be too high yet. And eventually what happened, and there was a strong environmental community here during that period, and I think still is, and there was a strong amount of resistance to continuing the amount of timber harvest that we had. And eventually, not just here, but throughout the Oregon and Washington, the results of all that was a much reduced level of harvest that has been in existence now for some time.
In them days, there were a few of us, and I'm sure there probably still are, that really love for the land. And I can go back now on the South Summit and see where, you know, it's out there in the head of Benson Creek and in that country, and even on the North Summit, where we've done a lot of good.
By the time I entered the Forest Service, it was a different place. There were 1994, the the forest plan came down, and that changed a lot of how the Forest Service managed things.
We went more from supplying the timber to restoring the timber stands that had been logged and were suffering from, you know, insects and disease and things like that. So restoration, seeing the Forest Service change to becoming an agency that was out there to really restore the environment was, you know, a real welcome change for me personally.
And finally, I give her up after 36 years. It was a long time, but it's a long time for any company, but it's a long time for the federal government. You know, times, so many things change.
Twist District was kind of the sleepy. Winthrop was the recreation district at the time. That's when the large ski area was being proposed up at Mazama, the Sandy Butte project, and it had 500,000 acre wilderness up there, and it was. Winthrop recreationally in the early 80s was extremely high profile. You just had the North Cascades Scenic Highway just had opened.
So we did have a lot of work to do, and but over the period, I would say 4 or 5 years, we were able to make some major changes, bring in some people who were I think very progressive, and we eventually the region had this program where they awarded a Ranger District of the Year award, and nobody ever thought that the Twist Ranger District could ever compete for something like that. But I felt at one point, I think it was, I don't know what year it was, 84 or 85, somewhere in there, that our district was doing so well and we were doing so many positive things that we applied for that to be considered. And we made the first cut, and the region team came out and toured the district, and we ended up winning the Ranger District of the Year award, which was, I think, a real high point for the Ranger District, and the people working there really felt good about that, and we all felt good about it.
So at this time, we had the big study, where is the best place for the Medhow Valley Ranger District? Is it gonna be the Winthrop office, or is it gonna be the Twist compound?
And it kept getting smaller and smaller here in this building, you know, and we would be to the point of, you know, we're stacking desks almost on top of one another with people. It was a great office situation as far as I was concerned, you know. It was, like I said earlier, the communication that goes on, you know, within, you know, is sometimes where we learn the most, and that certainly was the case for me. One of the fond memories I have was when we had what we called a desk race, where we actually, each department took a desk and somehow put wheels on the desk, and we actually had a race and pushed them up over on the Loop Loop Highway. Yeah, it was one of those things that was, it represented, you know, those changes, you know, and so what we were, that's exactly how we were doing that, you know, we were using those and as a way to deal with the changes that we were seeing.
Where it really struck me is we had taken all of our surplus desks and filing cabinets and lamps and supplies, and we had them out in one of these open, we had two open air warehouses out here that we put all these desks, and we had a public auction for the thing. In that one open air bay, there were 35 desks sitting in that bay. And 15 years before that, every single one of those desks had an employee sitting at it. That was the most visible thing that I saw that really struck us. You know, it's time.
We had a lot of empty desks when we relocated up to Winthrop. It was incredible the number of empty desks that we had surplus to our needs. And I was told that that there was no way that we were going to be able to sell as much as we had. We sold everything by the end of that day. So it showed, I felt very good about that. Yeah, we have empty desks. Things have changed a lot in our structure. But even tangible items such as a desk, there's somebody here that somebody here in the Metha Valley community that had a need for them.
There was a lot of factors that we had to look at, and primarily it was, where are we headed?
Making this site a surplus site was not an easy task, and it sold a lot of newspapers in this valley. It's still, within the Forest Service, you strike a nerve when you talk about this, because this is the compound that a huge amount of people started their career. You know, you always like it. It's like selling your mom's house. You can't go back and look at your old bedroom, you know? So there, it's a big deal.
Well, I think as a kid, I didn't really understand what the Forest Service did. Then having been a part of the forest, I realized there's so many different parts of the Forest Service. There are people that do roads, there are people that look at plants, there are wildlife biologists, there are fisheries people, there are timber people, there are mining resources people, there's fire people. I mean, I'm leaving out people. I mean, there's so many different parts of that organization.
For me, I enjoyed the people, number one, you know, and the jobs, number two. A job that I knew I really wanted to do when I was in school. You know, I wanted to spend the rest of my life out in the woods.
I'm glad I put my 35 years in. Yeah, I got a lot of work done, and I got a lot of really good memories.
I love it, and to be paid for watching lightning, I just love it. And to be the last lookout, that's very special. I never dreamed I'd be the last lookout in the valley.
And people like that are one in a million, you know. Bill Moody, one in a million, you know, that he's a school teacher by profession, but he's also a smoke jumper by heart, you know, and he loves to teach people how to smoke jump, how to fight fire, and he's done it from here to Russia.
Having been a part of that community, I was a part of a group of people that were truly passionate about what they did and about what they were working with, whether it was plants or wildlife or trees, really passionate about it and cared about it. It was their life, it was their career.
I was hopeful that at least, you know, it would come to something like this effort that would, you know, not only retain the importance of the history, but to also use these buildings and save the buildings and and you know, make it something that the public can really, really benefit by.
It's wonderful that this compound is able to give back to the community. I think that the organization that's here that's making that happen is fantastic.
The hard cold fact is that it was no longer a ranger station. There are many ways that could have played out, but I think the fact that we have Twist Works and a lot of things that they have planned through the interpretive center and trying to capture some of the history, the Forest Service history on the compound and so on, and many of the programs that I think that they have envisioned, I think are a real plus. And if it couldn't be a ranger district, I think that's probably the next best option.
In Their Voices was created by Dakota Clearwater LaCroix. A very special thanks to the people who lent their voices to this project. Without them, it wouldn't have been possible. And also to the artists who gave their sounds and a life to this project. Simple, Soltero, Sarah Middlefield, and John Gillette. This project was also made possible by an artist in residency provided by the Icicle Fund and Twist Works. To hear more stories from this artist, visit www.dakotalacroix.com. You can also hear these and other voices on the Twist Works Audio Tour, a collaboration with the North Central Washington Listening Post Network.